Here in 1 Kings 19, I think we could say that we have really the record of God firing Elijah. He had been the lead prophet, and at the end of this chapter, he's fired from his job and replaced by Elisha. And why is this? Well, it's because really of his arrogance and his insistence that he alone is faithful to God, and his utterly critical spirit towards all the others in Israel who were faithful. God tells him here that I've reserved 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. And the language of reserved means that God had marked them off. There was the hand of God by grace in preserving those people. Obadiah had hidden God's prophets, 50, in a cave. He was faithful to God, although he was Ahab's right-hand man. And of course, Elijah didn't think much of Obadiah, thought that he was not good enough, etc., because he was working for Ahab and so forth. And there was the widow woman who was faithful to him and who actually was used by God to keep him alive. But no, none of them were any good. And there's quite a few hints in the record that there were actually odds and ends of faithful people around. But no, Elijah's view was, no, this one's no good, she's no good, they're no good, I only am the only one who's in fellowship with God. And this was extremely upsetting to God. And so he seeks to humble him, not to punish him, but because he wants him saved. Well, he's told then to go 40 days journey towards Mount Sinai. And he is fed by an angel, just as the people of Israel were fed angels' food. Psalm 78 says that food provided by angels is what it means. And so he gets there, and it says that he goes into a cave. Well, verse 9, it's in the Hebrew, the cave. And I think it's the cave that on Sinai that is mentioned in Exodus 33, verse 12, more like a cleft in the rock. So there he is, and there's a great theophany, and he's expecting to hear Yahweh's voice, and he doesn't. There is a still small voice, and I think that that would be better translated, the voice of silence. There was no appearance like there was to Moses. There he was expecting to be as Moses, and he's being told, no, you're not Moses. Elijah, you think you are, but you're not. And so the apparent silence of God in this case was God's voice to Elijah. And that is, of course, a huge principle that we get so frustrated with the apparent silence of God, but it is actually at times his voice to us. And all the way through, he's being nudged to see that, in fact, he is not so wonderful as he thinks. God has tried to teach him that in chapter 17, when the unclean ravens come and bring him his meat. He has to live at the hand of unclean ravens. It's the widow woman who preserves him. We're told on two occasions that God fed Elijah with a cake when he was hungry. Once was when the widow woman baked him one and she was a Gentile, and once when the angel did, here in 1 Kings 19, verse 6. So I think God's trying to say to Elijah, look, I, in all my greatness, was manifested through that desperately poor, weak, sick, starving, probably Gentile widow woman. And it's the same message. God was not in the earthquake and the fire, but in the voice of silence, the sound of silence. It really is and was a sound of silence. Also, he sleeps, verse 5, under a juniper tree, and then an angel touches him and says, arise and eat. He's pretty well at the point of death. And it's similar, so similar, to Hagar being preserved by an angel in the very same wilderness. He's being shown, you know, better than Hagar, who was so despised. Well, what are we to make of this? We may think that this is a lesson for sort of hardline, young, harsh reformer types who arise from time to time in ecclesias and churches. And yeah, it is a message for those types that you are not in fact indispensable, nor is your critical spirit necessarily the spirit of God. And this comes to a head really in 2 Kings 1 when he calls fire down from heaven. And then Jesus quotes that and says, yeah, you disciples want to call fire down from heaven, but you don't know what manner of spirit you're of. The Son of Man came to save people, not to destroy people's lives. You don't have the true spirituality by doing this. So yes, it is a lesson for those types. But I think that it is actually for all of us, because we are all actually conservatives. We may say that, no, I'm not. I'm a liberal. So you think. So I think. So we say. But the Lord's observation is so true that a man who's drunk old wine does not then immediately want new wine. No man having drunk old wine immediately desires new, because he says the old is better. The Lord there is referring, I think, to the basic conservatism which is within us, which is part of our structure, part of our nature, our wiring. And this is our tendency to think that, no, you know, this is wrong, that is wrong, I am right. This is not pleasing to God at all. And he prays to God in verse 10 and says, I've been very zealous for Yahweh. The children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, slain your prophets. I, even I, only am left. Now, Romans 11, verses 2 and 3 interprets that as meaning that Elijah prayed to God against Israel in those words. Now, he was not actually, in so many words, praying for God to destroy them all, apart from himself. But that is how Paul interprets it rightly. That is effectively what he was saying, because God reads our attitudes as if they're our prayers, and that is a comfort for those who think they're not very good at verbalizing things. Maybe you're not. But being a good prayer, being able to pray well, as it were, is not a function of how good you are at verbalizing, how good you are at stringing words together. It can't be, because some people are better at that than others. God reads your innermost spirit as your prayer. That's why in the classic passage about intercession and mediation in Romans 8, Jesus, as our mediator, is called the Lord the Spirit. And he says, we know not how or what to pray for as we ought, but the Spirit, that is the Lord Jesus, makes intercession for us with groanings that cannot be uttered. That is, he interprets our essential spirit to God. And so Elijah was really praying that God would destroy Israel and make of him a great nation. And that's why when he's there in the cleft of the rock or the cave that Moses was in, the angel says, what are you doing here, Elijah? You know, you think you're Moses, don't you? But Moses was the very opposite. When God said, yes, I will destroy the people and make of you a great nation, he says, no, please don't do that. And God heard him. And so Elijah is really being fired. He's being told that, you know, you're not Moses. What are you doing here? And in fact, I'm going to replace you with Elisha. So the whole idea is that we should want to see other people's salvation. We read the story of Jonah and we think, how on earth could Jonah be like that? He actually wanted to see the Gentiles destroyed. He wanted to see Nineveh destroyed. And when God relents, he sort of says, yeah, I told you so, God. That's exactly what I thought you'd do. That's the trouble with you. You are a God that's very gracious and so on. Quoting God's very own self-declaration, self-revelation to Moses in Exodus 34. He didn't like how God was. He didn't like this aspect of God, because it is natural in human nature to want to judge others. It's because we subconsciously are aware that we deserve judgment, that we ourselves are sinners, and so we love to transfer our sin and the way we have a just desert for judgment onto other people, and then to stand over them and judge them. This is what Jonah did, this is what Elijah did, and it's there for our warning. And as I say, this is not just a warning for those who have come from conservative stables, as it were, within the conservative hard-line sort of Christian backgrounds. It is for them, but it is for all of us, because we all have this same basic tendency.